A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
They're frustrated, you know, they've gone to college, they've done all the right things, and they can't find a place to live. You know, they don't want to live with mom, they want to have their own place. They can't afford to live downtown and take advantage of the explosion of housing that's occurring there. And so I think this is going to be an exciting alternative and an opportunity.
LA City Councilman Curran Price talking about a new housing and retail development proposed for South LA. It's called The Reef. He supports it, but not everyone does. We'll have more on that controversy later on the show. But first, the election is a week away, and now, yes, we have our October surprise. The FBI is examining tens of thousands of emails that could or could not be related to Hillary Clinton and her use of a private email server. Today, FBI Director James Comey is being criticized for announcing the investigation on Friday, and some say he may have violated the law. Josh Gerstein covers the Justice Department and the White House for Politico. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Marilyn. Good to be back with you.
Well, today the focus seems to be on James Comey for that decision. And let's listen to what White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said today.
The president doesn't believe that Director Comey is intentionally trying to influence the outcome of an election. The president doesn't believe that he's secretly strategizing to benefit one candidate or one political party. He's in a tough spot. And he's the one who will be in a position to defend his actions in the face of significant criticism.
Okay, Josh, so tell us the nature of this significant criticism and what Comey has responded.
So the criticism has to do with this letter that he sent to Capitol Hill on Friday, which was most people have described it as a bombshell that probably understates its political significance at this point in the campaign. But it basically let various committee chairmen and the ranking Democrats on those committees know that the Clinton email investigation was being resumed, that they had found or come across potential additional emails relevant to the investigation during an unrelated investigation on another topic. It would later become clear that that other investigation involved Anthony Weiner, the estranged husband of longtime Clinton aide Huma Abedin, and that they either shared a laptop or somehow Anthony Weiner ended up with a laptop that had many of Huma Abedin's emails on it, and at least some of them seem to be from this period that was earlier investigated from the FBI by the FBI, and the FBI wanted to have a look at it. He has not really mounted a full defense of himself, but he did say, I think, in an internal memo to a short internal memo to FBI agents that he felt compelled, because he had told congressional committees he would keep them up to date on any developments, that to just sort of sit on this development in advance of the election would be a mistake and would not comply with the spirit of candor and transparency that he pledged to them, although he acknowledged that, you know, doing this at this point in the campaign, there would be a lot of second guessing of his decision, although whether he realized quite how much, who knows.
Yeah, and former Attorney General Eric Holder saying today that Comey, while he respects him enormously, made a huge mistake because there are guidelines set out by the Attorney General about when and when not to make statements near an election.
Yeah, there are a lot of prosecutors of both major political parties who have leveled that same criticism that Holder did, that there are policies in place discouraging, especially in the 60 days before an election, taking any kind of investigative steps like an indictment or some kind of public statement that would cause a candidate in the election to come under scrutiny. If you're going to do something like that, the general thinking is you should do it well in advance of the election so it can be digested by people. Other people have a chance to weigh in and not at the very last minute. That said, it's not a firm Justice Department rule. There have been other cases. I'm thinking of one involving the mayor here in the District of Columbia in D.C. That have had a similar kind of impact on the election Justice Department actions. But it is very unusual. But he, like I said, his position is that he was sort of between a rock and a hard place here, and that either way he was likely to be criticized, and he decided to opt for the more transparent route.
Okay, so now he might be in some kind of legal trouble, according to Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, who says that Comey may have violated a Depression-era law known as the Hatch Act.
Yeah, so Reid did make that argument in a letter that the FBI director might have broken the law, and there's also a New York Times op-ed by a Bush administration White House ethics lawyer making the same case, that you're not supposed to take official acts that are designed to or are likely to influence the political campaign unless you have some other good reason. And that's the tricky part here. You know, Comey is saying the good reason is his duty of completeness and candor regarding his earlier, you know, under oath testimony on Capitol Hill about how these investigations were being handled. So I don't think anything's going to come of these allegations. Harry Reid sometimes makes, you know, some pretty out there comments, as he did with Mitt Romney in the previous election. And so I don't think it's likely to be seriously pursued, but there are some people arguing that Comey's action went too far. As you mentioned also, though, the White House doesn't quite seem to, you know, weigh in that direction. They're saying they don't think there was any desire on Comey's part to, you know, to play a partisan role here, even though there are obviously a lot of people friendly to the White House who think Comey made a mistake in what he did on Friday.
So meanwhile, they're pouring through these emails, investigators. Will they be able to complete their investigation in the next week?
You know, they're under a lot of pressure to do that. It seems highly unlikely that they will. You know, there are said to be thousands of emails. There were supposedly more than 600,000 emails on this laptop. Only probably smaller number of them actually have any connection to Huma Abedin or the time period in question here, or something to do with State Department information that might potentially be classified. You know, if it turns out that these are 100% duplicates of things that she had already turned over earlier, it's possible they could verify that within a matter of a couple days. But it seems likely, knowing how a lot of these officials sometimes use their personal emails, if for purposes, say, to print documents out that they couldn't print from official systems, it seems at least likely that there are some emails here that, if not unique, are not going to be exactly what was already gone through, and that will probably lead to another round of examination of whether these are really classified. And that's not a decision the FBI can make, and it's just really not a decision, if there is new information here or new emails, that's going to be made on this political timeline people are suggesting of the next 8 days or so.
All right, Josh, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
That's Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House and Justice Department reporter for Politico. And we'd like to hear from you. Does this news about the emails, does it affect your vote? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW. Press play. Coming up, can you have development without displacement? How one proposed building in L.A. is the focus of both hope and anger. Also, how one developer is linked to hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. But some of the donations appear to have been made through some of his employees who had no idea they had contributed to politicians. That story is next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Downtown Los Angeles has experienced a renaissance over the last several years. High-rises, luxury lofts, fancy restaurants. Now that building boom is spreading south. A mile from LA Live, right on the other side of the 10 freeway, Washington Boulevard still looks untouched. It's clogged with traffic, surrounded by nondescript or rundown commercial buildings. But developers have a billion-dollar plan to transform the area. It's called The Reef. The Reef would turn what is now two parking lots into a 10-acre complex. There would be a pair of high-rises with 1,400 apartments and condos, a hotel, a grocery store, restaurants, and public gardens. For some, this sounds like exciting progress. For others, it represents everything that's going wrong with development in Los Angeles. Rich people elbowing out everyone else. Tomorrow, the project is supposed to go to a key city council committee for a vote.
The Reef is an exciting project. I think it's going to really transform this part of South L.A.
City Councilman Curran Price represents South L.A. His is the poorest of the 15 council districts. Price says the Reef will erase blight and provide much-needed housing and jobs.
We're excited about the 3,000 jobs that are going to be created, you know, with a preference for local hire. Construction jobs and jobs that are in place after the construction.
I like the construction jobs. That's always important. But where are the rest of the jobs? Having porters to park cars and things of that nature is not exactly what I consider to be high-end jobs.
Benjamin Torres is president and CEO of CD Tech. That's a nonprofit that focuses on economic development in low-income neighborhoods. We spoke near the intersection of Washington and Broadway, where the Reef would be built. Torres and other opponents say the Reef isn't for current South L.A. residents. It's to attract new, rich ones.
The household income in this area is about $28,000 a year, and you have a lot of people working, trying to survive by paying low rents. These kind of projects, like the Reef, are starting to impact the area in a way where rents are going up, not only for residents, but also for mom-and-pop small businesses.
The city's planning commission has recommended that 5% of the apartments in the Reef be affordable for low-income tenants. Torres says that is not nearly enough. The developers of the Reef are two brothers, Avedis and Ara Tavedian. They're both medical doctors. 6 years ago, they opened the Atwater Crossing Complex in Atwater Village. They declined to be interviewed for this story. But City Councilman Curran Price defends their project, saying it's providing housing where there isn't any.
It's two parking lots. You know, we opened up a shopping center, the first shopping center in 50 years, on Slauson and Central Avenue, anchored by a Northgate, a Starbucks, a Panda Express, CVS drugstore, Yogurtland, Fatburger. The shopping center has just done gangbusters. There's pent-up demand. People want the kinds of services that are available every place else. And if you can do it on the someone else's pocketbook, then that's the kind of project I want to see.
So the Planning Commission has recommended that 5% be
Correct.
Set aside.
Correct.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that certainly is acceptable.
And the developer's okay with that?
Yes, I believe they're satisfied with that.
And as well as they would pay a certain amount of money into a fund to build affordable housing elsewhere?
Well, you know, not a certain amount of money. This is going to be $18 million. This is a package that's unprecedented in the annals of development, not just in the 9th District, but really citywide.
Most of that $18 million will go to what's called the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. That pays for low-income housing all over Los Angeles. Price says he'll use some of that money to preserve existing affordable housing in his district by paying landlords to extend affordable housing covenants. These are agreements where landlords keep rents low for a certain number of years in exchange for some financial breaks from the city.
What if they say no, we're not going to extend the covenant?
And then we lose it.
And then do you build something else?
Well, we have to find a place for that family to live, don't we?
If I'm a property owner, you think that I'm going to say, sure, I'll stay at covenants? Come on, that's ridiculous.
Benjamin Torres, the economic justice advocate, he says his organization isn't anti-development. It just wants to make sure projects like the Reef offer something to current residents in the area.
This is just one project. This is a big city. This is a big neighborhood. Why is this so important to you?
Because these set precedents. This is super important because once this project goes through, there'll be other projects that come in. And, you know, developers don't like to upend each other. Like, they don't like to upend in terms of, I'm going to provide more benefits than the last developer. Usually they try and stay below that threshold. There has to be a standard across the city in neighborhoods like South Central, like Echo Park, like Boyle Heights, like Highland Park, other MacArthur Park, areas that are going to transition. And unless you have that, then you're going to have a development city that's driven by developers who's looking out for the interests of the community.
One community member, Debbie Alvarez, is afraid she'll lose her apartment because of the ripple effect from the Reef.
You have to have change. You have to have progress. But it doesn't mean that it has to come at the cost of the people that are hardworking and don't have the money to move.
Alvarez lives in a dilapidated building about a mile from where the Reef would be. The walls inside her tiny studio are covered with snapshots of her grandchildren.
How long have you lived here?
About 2 years.
Alvarez works as a home health care aide. Her husband is disabled. Together, they bring in about $1,400 a month and spend half on rent. Recently, their building was sold. The new owner, an affordable housing developer called AmCal, did not respond to our questions. But Alvarez is afraid she'll eventually have to move, which she says she can't afford.
You know, even if they help us move out and give us money to move, we're still going to be paying more rent there. So how long is that going to last? And how are we going to afford the rent after that?
And is it the problem with the reef, or is it something bigger than that? Is the reef just a manifestation of the changes that are happening?
I think the reef is just, you know, it's happening all over LA. I saw that before I even heard about the reef. So I think the reef is just like, it's the big thing right now. And I think it's going to affect so many people, even though, you know, there's nobody living in the parking lot they're going to build on. Still, all the apartment buildings, all the housing around there is affected. So where are we going to be? Out on the street.
For people who own property, however, the idea that the reef could attract other investors is exciting.
Okay, so this is our lobby.
Vivian Bowers owns Bowers and Sons Dry Cleaner on Central Avenue, a mile and a half from the reef. Her mother and father opened the business here more than 50 years ago.
My parents really thought my brothers would be here instead of myself. So, Bowers and Sons.
My husband, Greg.
In the lobby, Vivian's husband, Greg Cowan, points to the framed album covers and photos of celebrities covering the walls.
If you ever have a business where it's a service business and people have to wait, distract them. If you distract them, they won't notice the wait.
So I'm looking at all the pictures.
Exactly.
Greg Cowan and Vivian Bowers are all for the reef.
This area has been so poor for so long. I see it as an opportunity for us to blend the new with the old.
Is there enough affordable housing here?
That's all there is here. And this is the first market rate housing to come in here since I can remember.
What does that say to you? What is the symbolism of that?
Progress. You know, I asked some people that are opposed to it, do you want your children to not have something to look forward to reach for? Or do you want them to be in the doldrums forever and just stay in this little underdeveloped area and just say, this is where I live? And I can only go visit Westwood. I can only get in the train and go to Santa Monica, and then I come back home, and woe is me. No, we can have the same thing. We can have a theater, a bowling alley, some programs for the elderly. Hopefully we'll have a skateboard park one day. Things that children can do that they do in other areas where you don't have to go away. We can be a destination, and people come here and see us.
And you think the reef represents all of that?
I think the reef is, it's a spark. To me, it's a spark of hope. It's a spark of life. It says, you know what? Over there isn't so bad.
It could be many years before that spark comes to life. There's no groundbreaking date yet set for the reef. It still needs to be approved by a key committee tomorrow and then go before the entire city council. And then the developers would have a long time to build it before their plans expire, 20 years. But already, before a single shovel has hit the ground, the reef has begun to reshape this corner of South LA. Well, one criticism against big projects like the reef is that developers often get their way at City Hall because they help fund political campaigns. But there's a difference between ordinary campaign donations and what the Los Angeles Times uncovered in a new investigation into a project called Seabreeze. Seabreeze is a $72 million apartment complex planned near the Port of Los Angeles. Last year, city council members unanimously approved it with no discussion. They went against the recommendation of their own planning commission. Now the Times has found hundreds of campaign donations from people connected to the developer, more than $600,000 to local politicians. But some of those contributors had no idea they had donated to these politicians, raising the specter that the developer made the contributions in their name without their knowledge. David Zanheiser covers City Hall for the Times, and he co-wrote the story. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, let's begin where you began in your article. You described this dilapidated house in South LA. Why did you begin there, and what does that say about your story?
So the house, the front window is broken and actually has been broken for 6 to 8 months. The front yard is dirt. People who've lived at this house actually have provided more than $40,000 in donations over the last 8 years. One of the housemates told us that there were two families and an individual living in this three-bedroom house with the rent going at about $500 a bedroom. So we were thinking, like, that is an unusual source of money. I knocked on the door and I asked one of the people there who is listed as a multiple donor, because this person had given more than once to Janice Hahn, who was on the council and represented the Seabreeze site in her campaign for lieutenant governor. Why did you give to Janice Hahn? And this person told me he could not remember.
Right, so why would they contribute to Janice Hahn? Or anybody if they're not wealthy?
At least some of the people who are inside this house work at buildings that are owned by the developer of the project, Seabreeze. Basically, what we did was, when we looked for these 100 donors, we found a number of people who worked at buildings where this developer is either the owner or an executive or has some other officer title. There were construction workers, and there was a gardener, and there was a chef, and there were people who provide, like, children's educational services at a residential complex in Northridge. And it was their family members and some of their family members' relatives. You know what I mean? It just went, like, it went and went and went on. And there were some people who were quite wealthy who were donors, people who live in Granada Hills and Pasadena and the hills of Palos Verdes, and then other people who were really very working class. They live in South Los Angeles or Koreatown or North Hollywood and were of modest means. And we had 11 people who said that either they did not give or they did not remember giving. And we went to the experts and we were saying, what does this mean? And they said, you know, if they say they don't remember, that raises the possibility that they weren't the true source of the money and that it's possible someone may have actually reimbursed them for the money.
Did you actually find that reimbursement?
We had one donor who said, yes, she was reimbursed. One donor in the San Fernando Valley who discussed this very briefly with us. I have to say it was very difficult because with these donors, you would be able to get, you know, one shot with them to talk with them, and then you could set up an appointment to go back to discuss details, and they would never call you back again.
Hmm.
So, you know, the story is about two things. One is that it's about a large amount of money, more than $600,000. Many of them to campaigns where the limit was $500 a donor. And then the second part of the story is that some of this money is very weird. And so we wanted to show the mystery because a lot of this stuff is a mystery. You know, we did not find every answer to every question. What we're doing at this point still really is raising questions.
Well, okay, so one of my questions is, who's the developer? And tell us more about this person.
The developer is a fellow named Samuel Leung, and again, he's developing this 352-unit apartment in Harbor Gateway. I mean, lots of apartments get approved in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I want to be clear. Lots of apartments get deviations from city rules like this developer did, but this one was an outlier on a few levels. The planning department staff opposed it. Mayor Eric Garcetti's own planning commission unanimously opposed it. One neighborhood council right south of the site, basically across the street, opposed it, and it was approved anyway. Samuel Leung has a number of different companies, as I said. Like, he has a title with a hotel company in Long Beach. He has companies that have bought up single-family houses. He helped develop a 136-unit building in San Pedro. You could not look at the records that were filed for these contributions and know this. Hmm. You couldn't know what these connections were. Like, we had to take months. If there's someone who lives in Harbor City who opposed this project, and there were people who opposed this project in Harbor City, they couldn't simply go into the city's Ethics Commission's records and look at the donation records and have any clue what type of money was in play.
Okay, so did the politicians, though, have a clue? Did they know where these contributions were actually coming from?
I don't think we know at this point. I've asked them, you know, they say contributions have no involvement. I asked Joe Buscaino specifically, did you raise some of this money for some of these committees that, you know, he was honorary chairman? And his spokesman said, we just don't have a way of knowing.
Now, what about Mayor Garcetti? He also got some donations to a committee that wasn't working directly with him.
Let me back up. So in 2013, Garcetti was running for mayor. And one of his big supporters was a councilman, Joe Buscaino. Joe Buscaino represents the district where Seabreeze had been proposed and was still being considered at that time. Joe Buscaino was raising money for an independent expenditure committee to get Garcetti elected. This committee takes in about $60,000 from companies and individuals who are connected directly or indirectly with our developer. Joe Buscaino raised money for that committee. We asked him about that, and the sort of blanket answer we received from the councilman's office was, well, we don't know that that was that money or not. And so Garcetti, a year later, after his own commissioners vote to reject the project, he then signs a sheet of paper that actually lowers the vote threshold for the council to approve it.
And he says, instead of 12, we can have 10 votes.
Yes. I only know of two cases since he became mayor that he's done this.
So what does he say is the reason for doing that?
This is basically the statement from everybody, and it's not an unreasonable policy argument. They're saying the city needs housing. It needs housing everywhere. It needs housing for everybody. Garcetti said he needs, to build 100,000 units by 2021. This gets him toward his goal. Joe Buscaino says constituents are thirsting for housing, and this was an empty lot that in his mind was a completely reasonable site to put residences.
So it's not illegal to accept these campaign contributions, right?
It is not illegal to accept, no.
However, there are limits to how much someone can contribute to a campaign.
That's true.
But it is also illegal to reimburse someone for a campaign contribution.
Yes, that would be a violation of campaign finance law at the city level or the state level or the federal level. And there were contests at all three levels.
So there are how many possible different kinds of laws broken here?
Well, we have exactly one person who says they were reimbursed. What we have said is we are seeing things that, as I said at the beginning, are weird. Like, it is weird if you are a working class repair person that you don't remember $11,000 in donations you made over a 2 to 3 year period, mm-hmm. even if you're not necessarily working class. We had people who said they did not remember donations they made 11 months earlier. We had people who denied straight up giving. And there are other possibilities, but it does raise the question, if they don't remember or they remember so little, were they the true source of the money?
Well, David, thank you so much for your reporting and your story.
Well, thank you.
That's David Zanheiser. He covers City Hall for the LA Times. Coming up in the program, the LA restaurant that changed breakfast.
We had to step out of the comfort zone of normal eggs and hollandaise sauce and just try and think of things that we'd actually like to play with as if we were dinner chefs.
Jessica Coslow of Squirrel has a new cookbook. That's next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day and find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. For those of you who live in or near Silver Lake, you're probably familiar with the line of people that snakes down Virgil Avenue most mornings and afternoons outside the restaurant Squirrel. Customers can wait upwards of an hour for a chance to try chef and owner Jessica Coslow's take on California cooking. And if the wait sounds daunting, well, you can now make some of those recipes, including her acclaimed sorrel pesto rice bowl, in your own home. Coslow has a new cookbook out. It features some of these dishes. It's called Everything I Want to Eat, Squirrel and the New California Cooking, and she's here now. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, so will people just forget about the line and just cook at home with these recipes? Can they do that easily?
I think they can. I have some customers who come in every day. It's a very neighborhood spot, who now have the book, and I turn to them and I say, I hope to see you soon. But the truth is, I will see them soon. These recipes, they give away the kind of tricks, techniques, and backstory behind the dishes. But some of them can be time consuming. There's components involved. So it takes a month in order to preserve lemons, but you could get them from the store.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that I will still be seeing them around.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay, so it's called Squirrel and the New California Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
What is New California Cooking?
It's a great question. when I think of California cooking, I think of this idea that a peach is a peach and a pear is a pear. And we really work minimally on these fruits and vegetables in order to make them shine. That is what I think of as California cuisine, just the best produce picked in front of you that day. And what I think of as new California cuisine might be still seeing a peach for a peach, but seeing it as ways to develop flavors out of that fruit in other ways and utilize them in a dish. So you might have a peach and also ferment it into, let's say, a kombucha, or you might take cabbage and have it in a salad and also ferment it into sauerkraut. And there are these ways to bring and develop flavor of a vegetable or a fruit by doing something else to them. For example, the jam. You know, take strawberries and you can also preserve them for years to come.
Okay, you brought up the jam, and that's so let's use that to get to your origin story. And it starts with jam. And well, probably starts before jam, but let's begin with the jam.
Yeah.
You were making jam and selling it to other stores and to farmers markets, things like that.
Yeah.
And then you expanded to the toast because you have to put the jam on something.
Yep. That's correct. Sometimes people are like, why wasn't it a dinner restaurant? And I'm like, that's exactly right, Madeline. Because
jam.
Jam.
It starts with jam. So it goes to toast. And then it goes to, oh, well, what if someone wants something savory? So hence the rice bowl.
I think it was if someone is gluten-free.
Oh.
How do we accommodate them with not just gluten-free toast, with something that is a staple of California, which this rice farm in Northern California, it's one of the oldest rice farms in California. It has a variety of rice that they brought over in the early 1900s. And so that started making me think, you know, it's not only just about the savory dishes for customers, but how can I interact with the farmers in a way that I'm interacting with them on the jam level?
Let's talk about the famous sorrel pesto rice bowl, which you write in your cookbook. If you took it off the menu, you'd go out of business pretty much.
Yeah.
Why is that such the squirrel dish?
Gosh, you know, you're right. Like there's something so satisfying about it and also so savory. It's one of those, I don't know, but it is. And it's the thing that I drove over here today, shoveling it in my mouth in my car. Still to this day, I'm eating it. It just hits all the right notes.
So what's in it?
It's a brown rice from Coda Farms, a sorrel pesto that we made that has no nuts, a preserved lemon. You know, California has gorgeous Meyer lemons, so preserving them for a month. It also has dill, and then it's topped with our fermented, lacto-fermented hot sauce, which is a jalapeno pepper that's been fermented, feta, which adds a nice tanginess, and a soft poached egg.
Mm. So that gives a silkiness to it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like that last thing makes it breakfast. I think everything before that, you're like, is this lunch? But somehow with that egg, you're like, oh, this is breakfast.
And how did you come up with that? How did you think that this would be something that people wanted to eat? Because it was fairly a new idea at the time, the rice bowl.
I think it starts with what I want to eat. And I think that's why the title of the book is what it is. It's like it's everything that I personally want to eat.
And so that dish is the squirrel dish. So is the toast. But how do you feel about it becoming, your restaurant becoming this, I guess, this hipster marker or something beyond just a restaurant? It's become kind of a symbol in a sense.
A symbol for breakfast and lunch, a symbol for
For a lifestyle.
Yeah, a lifestyle.
Yeah. Like a Silver Lake.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Lifestyle.
Because I don't think that was the goal to begin with. The goal was to develop dishes and recipes that felt delicious to us. And it meant taking a lot of risks because we had to step out of the comfort zone of normal eggs and hollandaise sauce, you know, a waffle, and just try and think of things that we'd actually like to play with and develop as if we were dinner chefs. And somehow that creativity and that playfulness is the thing that makes us stand out as, you know, maybe a youthful spirit. It gives us a youthful spirit. And I'm okay with that. And what's more interesting to me is seeing over the course of Squirrel's life, which is coming up on 5 years, seeing so many other restaurants in our neighborhood in the U.S. grow out of this model. So it's it's rewarding at the same time.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jessica Coslow. She is the owner of Squirrel. She has a new cookbook out. It's called Everything I Want to Eat. And midway through the book, you have this chapter. I don't know quite what to make of it. It seems like you're confessing to being a criminal.
I guess so. Michael Krikorian is a writer in Los Angeles. He actually writes a lot of crime stories for the LA Times. So he has a blog in which he writes really funny crime stories about crimes of palate humanity, you know, like a loaded baked potato that was just so bad that it was good, those kinds of things. And if you're in the food world, you tend to follow his stories and the humor. And so I asked him to write one on behalf of myself and Squirrel. So this is his tribute.
So did it really happen?
It did not really happen. I know. I've had emails being like, I tried the link out and it took me nowhere. And I'm like, yes, it was a joke. It's not actually real, but it's a great story. And it's
great. It's really
sweet.
Charming. It's really funny. Well, it does illustrate that this book, it seems to be very personal. You've got pictures of your customers in here, mm-hmm. and they are, you know, part of the story of Squirrel.
I think the restaurant is not only about food, or a good restaurant is not only about food, but it's also about the community that it breeds. And that is not just the customers that walk through the door, but also the people that work there. And so this book is really to honor this place and the people who breathe in it. And I think it did a good job of not only sharing a voice, and that voice is within the recipes, kind of talking you through the recipes and making sure that you're okay and that you can make it. Because the recipes can span from being quite easy to quite difficult. But it also carries a nice voice of what you can expect when you actually go to the restaurant.
You have a lot of recipes there that call for, as you say, preserved lemon or homemade ricotta cheese. Mm-hmm. And that maybe could seem a little daunting to mm-hmm. the home cook to assemble all of these ingredients. Do you need to really do that to make the recipe truly squirrelish?
I mean, if it's at Squirrel, yes. But at home, the book always says, look, there's a recipe for gnocchi in here. It says, you don't want to make this gnocchi, go to the store, buy some delicious gnocchi, and go to step four, or, you know, something along those lines. And that's the thing that this book is trying to say, is like, if you don't have the ingredients, there's something you can always go either find a replacement or remove some of it. There's always an ability to make it your own.
So you're expanding your empire to another restaurant mm-hmm. in Culver City. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
It's the restaurant is in Sawtell. It's off Barrington between Olympic and Pico. It was an old Office Depot. And it is a beautiful space that is being redeveloped into a restaurant. It is Middle Eastern and Eastern European Jewish diaspora food, basically, in a California setting. And I think the more interesting thing about the project, or one of the things that's interesting, is that we have a 2.5 acre farm in Malibu that we're growing a lot of our own produce on. But this is drought tolerant produce, basically fruits and vegetables that we can grow with very little water that can help define what California food can be about.
In the future. With a less water bountiful future.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is we're growing a lot of cactus right now for the paddles and for the prickly pears. We're growing a lot of dragon fruit and passion fruit, which takes very little water. I said we're growing carob so that we can process that and also turn that into syrup. And then there's things like avocados and citrus that kind of just, once they're implanted in the ground, they do their part pretty well without needing so much water. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because as chefs, we tend to have desires for things like arugula, which take a lot of water. And if we can start to see what doesn't need that, we can kind of shift chef trends as well.
So you talked about prickly pear, mm-hmm. Cactus, that kind of thing.
Yes.
That's something you'd associate with Mexican food.
Although it is very present in Israel.
Is it?
Yeah. So.
Which I guess makes sense. Same, yeah. Similar climate.
So for me, that is an interesting thing of like, what we know it as is something that comes from Mexico, but it actually also is very widely used in Israel.
And why were you interested in exploring Jewish cuisine?
I mean, it's the thing that holds the most nostalgia for me. It's what I grew up with. I mean, the brioche with ricotta and jam is an absolute blintz. It is the squirrel version of a blintz. And so that is the food that feels the most like the food that I grew up eating. And it was kind of this mishmash of like delis and Israeli food. And it's interesting to see that they're always regulated to like one four-walled restaurant. And there's nothing really talking about the conversation of, you know, that this was a movement of people and where they ended up and resided defined the food that they ate. So for me, having something like bagels where instead of having an everything bagel, they're doused in za'atar and sesame bagels have nigella seeds. And there's a conversation about cottage cheese being used in, as a schmear instead of cream cheese, which is a very Polish thing. So these are kind of the elements of food that I want to bring into the conversation, but not making it strictly tabbouleh or strictly lox and bagels.
What about the matzah? Will you elevate the lowly matzah?
I've tried. Make it edible? You know, the interesting thing about Jewish food is that I feel like it's very nostalgic. So matzah brei, when we have it at Squirrel, like for the holidays, we got a lot of people saying, this isn't the matzah brei I grew up with. And you're at Squirrel, you should know that that's not what you're going to get, you know? It should already be weird enough that you know this is going to be different than what you grew up with. So I think by saying, hey, this is not this type of restaurant, I'm hopeful that I'm able to create like new normals in the way that I've been able to do so at Squirrel.
Well, Jessica Kozlov, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. That's Jessica Kozlov. She has a new cookbook out. It's called Everything I Want to Eat. And she also has a new restaurant opening up in the spring called
Nameless.
No name. Oh, my gosh. That's
it's
daunting.
It's a daunting task to give a restaurant its name.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to finding out eventually.
Yeah.
In April. When it opens.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, L.A. can be creepy, some places more than others. We'll find out where L.A.'s real haunted houses are next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What could possibly be more terrifying than this election season? Well, nothing. But today, we'll attempt to top the freak show that is American politics in honor of Halloween. Los Angeles is chock full of creepy old buildings with bloody pasts. Places that Colin Dickey is here to tell us about. He's the author of the book Ghostland and American History in Haunted Places. Hi, Colin.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you on. Is L.A., you've done a big tour of the nation, is L.A. more or less haunted than other cities?
L.A. is lousy with ghosts. It is fabulously haunted. And I was maybe expecting, I mean, you'd think maybe some of the older cities on the East Coast, you know, Salem, Massachusetts or Richmond, Virginia might be more haunted. But L.A. turns out to have as many ghosts per capita as any of those old cities. So I'm proud to report Angelenos are doing just fine with the afterlife.
Oh, thank God. Okay, well, let's begin with one of the more ghostly hotspots. This is the Cecil Hotel downtown. It has been revamped, but it still has a creepy past.
Yeah, I think it's now known officially as the Stay on Main. But it for many of its years, it was the Hotel Cecil, and it is a famously haunted house hotel. It is actually apparently the basis for that show American Horror Story. They did a season based on the Cecil, and it's I mean, in some senses, it's just sort of your garden variety, semi-derelict flop house in downtown Los Angeles. But, you know, it has been home to a couple of serial killers over the years that have stayed there. And it you know, it's just kind of, you know, grandly decaying in its style. But what really propelled it to the forefront of American consciousness happened a few years ago when a woman traveling from Canada stayed there and disappeared, and her body was later found in the water tank on the roof of the building. And that and the ensuing fallout of that story is really what made it known to the internet as such a haunted place.
Why? Because her ghost allegedly traipses through the Cecil to this day?
Yeah, I mean, before they found her body, the police released a video from the elevator security cam of one of the last known sightings ever, you know, just hoping to get leads. And it is without a doubt a genuinely creepy video. She comes into this elevator, and she, for about 3 minutes, she's kind of hiding as if she's trying to hide out of sight. And every so often, she kind of peeks out into the corridor, and it looks like maybe she's talking to somebody in the hallway, but you never see whom. And then at some point she leaves. But the thing I can never quite figure out is that during the entire video, the elevator doors stay wide open even when she's not touching any of the buttons. And then when she finally leaves after 3 minutes, they mysteriously close almost immediately.
Okay, just to get you on the record, do you believe in ghosts?
I am somewhere in the middle. I think that people expect that when you ask that question, there's a bright and sharp line between believers and skeptics. And I think the more people that I talk to, the more I found that most of us are actually somewhere in the middle. And I'd put myself there, too. I mean, I think a lot of us have seen things maybe we can't quite explain, or maybe we want to believe in ghosts, but we've never actually seen one. You know, I mean, I think that there's just a variety of beliefs out there. And I think that's kind of more fascinating than this kind of either or, yes, no kind of black, white question.
Yeah. Well, and that they might stand in for something else that we're afraid of.
Exactly. I mean, I think in the end result, I'm less interested in ghosts and more interested in ghost stories. And I think that the stories that we tell about a haunted place, the stories that we tell about a decaying hotel or, you know, an untouched mansion or, you know, a cemetery. I mean, I think those stories are more fascinating and more revealing about who we are and, you know, maybe, you know, our cultural anxieties or frustrations than any actual sort of existence or of the paranormal or lack thereof.
Okay, so Cecil Hotel, what else is a creepy, ghostly place in L.A.?
Another hotel that I was surprised is haunted is the Westin Bonaventure, the great sort of postmodern contemporary hotel downtown with the glass cylinders, and it looks very futuristic, and you would think it maybe be the last place that would have you know, old ghosts in it, but it turns out it has its share of ghosts as well. I mean, in part because you know, as with any hotel, given enough time, there's been murder and mayhem in some of the rooms. That one's also fascinating because its basement goes down into an original terminal for the old Red Line, and supposedly down somewhere in the catacombs beneath the Bonaventure, there is a ghost of a young girl in a red dress who wanders around these dark corridors. And I think that haunting story, I think, is a great example of the kind of way that LA's sort of geology sort of layers its history and strata, that, you know, on the ruins of a former era of LA would this new hotel would rise, and that these ghosts would be a way of connecting the past to the present.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because the Bonaventure, when it was built in the 70s, was seen as this really sort of very modern, futuristic building.
Right, and exactly. And that's another thing I found is, I mean, if you've spent any time in the lobby of the Bonaventure, I mean, it is a disturbing building to be in. I mean, you know, there's no windows
ghosts
to the
no
outside. Side.
Yeah,
exactly. There's no windows there. You know, it looks like a sort of futuristic prison with its, you know, weird sort of floating galleys and staircases sort of out of nowhere. And I think that again and again is what I found is it's the buildings that make you feel odd or strange or a little bit off kilter. Those are the ones that seem to have the most ghosts, I found.
So you've mentioned two places downtown. I would have thought if you're going to think about creepy hotels that maybe the Chateau Marmont might have some good ghost stories in there.
It does. I mean, well, it has ghost stories. And truly, any hotel in Los Angeles is going to be haunted by the ghosts of Marilyn Monroe and Rudolph Valentino and maybe one or two other celebrities and Elvis thrown in for good measure.
Just bar hopping from hotel to hotel.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there, you know, it just comes with the territory. It's, you know, you get your food license, you get your Marilyn ghost.
Okay. Now, I understand you were inspired to write your book after you bought a house in Echo Park. That was pretty creepy.
Yeah, well, the house we ended up buying, thankfully, was not that creepy. But certainly when we were looking, we saw a number of pretty strange houses. And this was in 2008, and it was at the beginning of the foreclosure crisis. And we didn't have a lot of money at the time, so we weren't, you know, looking at nice houses. We were looking at, you know, distressed properties. And I found myself thinking again and again about the lives of the people who had lived in these houses. And I kept coming back to the language of haunting, even though, you know, I didn't necessarily feel that there were, you know, paranormal or supernatural events going on. I just felt haunted by these past inhabitants. And so that's kind of what propelled me to maybe try and understand why we default to the language of ghosts and hauntings to understand these the way that the past kind of presses on us in certain buildings.
Colin Dickey is author of Ghostland and American History in Haunted Places. Thanks, Colin. Happy Halloween.
Thanks so much. You too.
Julie Myers, and happy Halloween to you, too.
Hello, trick-or-treat,
just
Madeline.
As yourself.
That is,
as promised,
terrifying. So we asked our listeners today what the creepiest spots in Los Angeles are. And, you know, I think of creepy as kind of old, spooky Victorian houses on a hill, old church graveyards, that kind of thing. But I'm from the Midwest, where everything's just a little bit older than it is here. So we have to settle for things like the Farmer John in Vernon, which has a deeply creepy mural with a pig that has human eyes. That's a R.C. Langley says that. I just retweeted a picture of it, and it is super creepy. So that it takes the number one spot as far as I'm concerned today. Gabby Lima tweeted that the Donut Time in Hollywood is a pretty creepy place to be, especially at night, though I think that's shut down.
I think
down
it's
recently.
Shutting down, yeah.
Rick said on Facebook that the mausoleum in the basement of Los Angeles Catholic Cathedral, he said that he was there when no one else was, but there was a security guard that sort of creeped into the end of the hall, which made Rick scream out loud and curse him in a church, and the security guard just smirked and walked out. Apparently, he likes playing the ghost. Irene Luna Guzman says that the Queen Mary is really creepy,
oh,
and
yeah.
They actually play that up, right? They sell
do.
Like tickets to the haunted Queen
That's
Mary
right.
thing. Besides the Farmer John and Vernon, winner number two today is Brady Westwater, who says that the 405 on Friday evening after a bit of rain is the scariest place in Los Angeles.
Let's get real.
That's
Mic
right.
drop yep. right there.
You could actually hand out candy to various cars on the 405 on Friday.
All right. That's a good idea. No, that's not
that's
a good
idea.
Terrible idea, Julie Myers. But thank you for that. Thank you for everything, actually. And have a happy Halloween. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.